Dad Bod History.
Welcome to this episode of Dad Bod History.
Dad Bod History.
The drinks are cold and the takes are old. Thank you for that, Eric. How you doing?
Fantastic.
Awesome, man. We got a good episode for you guys tonight. We're going to go over some old news. Talk about the discovery of the home of St. Peter.
I worry that somebody listening to this episode during the morning will get confused when you said this episode tonight. Okay. And I hope nobody's clock gets confused.
Well, thank you for today's this episode within this 24-hour cycle, August 1st.
You can listen to the episode over several days too.
You
can so to
whatever you want, morning,
do
night, dusk,
whatever on. You want.
Mm-hmm. But we got some good stuff. We're going to go over some old news. Discovery of possibly the home of St. Peter, a Bronze Age arrowhead made from a meteorite found in Switzerland. Elite special forces of ancient Rome, which were not that special when you actually dig into it. And then probably the best old news was lost for centuries. Emperor Nero's theater has been found under a hotel in ancient Rome. Then our
Great.
Main topic, yeah, no, it's going to be a good one. Then our main topic tonight, war machine, paradigm shifting weapons. So kind of in reflection on Oppenheimer coming out and how the bomb changed everything for the modern world. What other technologies changed everything? Fates of nations, how war was waged.
We're not talking about these guns.
I mean, we can, obviously. So paradigm shifting weapons, like Eric's cannons there. And then I got a little question about tipping. Have we gone too far to wrap up
yes.
the episode? Okay. Oh, well, there you go. So let's get
That's
into
the
it.
Answer.
Old news. I'm going to use my newscaster voice now.
Oh, all right.
This is Erasmus Brownstone reporting old news. Discovery of Greek inscription reveals home of St. Peter. This is from thegreekreporter.com, so you can go check it out there. A 1,500-year-old mosaic inscription discovered recently in what was the city of Bethsaida, Israel, could be proof that the place was once the home of the apostles of Jesus Christ, St. Peter and Andrew. Archaeologists from Kinneret College in Israel and Nyack College, New York, led by Professor Mordecai Avium and Professor Stephen Notley, have recently uncovered a large Greek inscription during excavations of what is being called the Church of the Apostles, a Byzantine basilica at El Araj Bet Habek. The translation of the inscription bolsters the basilica's identification with the church, described by the 8th century bishop Eichstadt Willibald, the first known Englishman to visit the Holy Land, which, I mean, that's got to be auspicious, the first known Englishman to visit the Holy Land. Who wouldn't want to be the first? Who reported a church built over the house of St. Peter in his travel logs. It references a donor, Constantine, servant of Christ, and continues with a petition for intercession by St. Peter, chief and commander of the heavenly apostles, a title routinely used by the Byzantine Christian writers to refer to Apostle Peter. Framed with a round medallion in a black tesserae, with two lines of black tesserae, the inscription forms the part of a larger mosaic floor in the church's sacristy that is partly decorated with floral patterns, the excavation project announcement explained. So there you have it, the home of St. Peter, right there.
Maybe. Interesting.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I always find it interesting, you know, when these archaeological digs uncover the legend, specifically like Christian relics or, possibly the home of St. Peter or, you know, the burial place of certain saints or apostles and stuff like that.
The Lost Ark.
Yeah. And it's so fascinating because it's like, I want, as a Christian, I want to believe this stuff that, yeah, this is it. But also it's like, even reading the article, you're like, well, this is just based on a guy from the 8th century England who visited the Holy Land and said, hey, this might be the home of St. Peter. And I'm sure there's more to the story than that, but it's not like, you know, it's not like there was a post box like saying Apostle Peter outside, like this is his house. It's based on, you know, myth and legend all kind of stacked on top of one another. And then by the 8th century, everyone kind of thought, yeah, this is probably where Peter lived and Andrew. But we don't know that, you know, and so it may or may not be, but it's just kind of interesting how these legends develop.
And I believe Peter, gosh, I'm going to get my apostles mixed up.
Oh, you're going to tick somebody.
Oh, man. He's the one, like, Peter's mother-in-law keeps showing up, which points to the fact that he's also married. So this isn't, often look at the apostles as, and the disciples as just like these 12 bachelors, but they weren't. They had families. I believe it was Peter references his mother-in-law. So like he had a wife, he had a family. And so they were also likely involved in.
Yeah, it says Peter in Matthew 8:14 through 17, Mark 1:29 through 31, and Luke 48. Peter's mother-in-law, how Peter's mother-in-law was healed by Jesus in their home in Capernaum. So this clearly depicts that he was either married or had, you know, was a widow. Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
No, that is interesting because you're right. Like we look at it, like you said, they're 12 bachelors and all they did was just follow.
Just carouse. All over the Holy Land.
Rome, just cutting it up. And yeah, they catch some fish every now and then, but they just live that free lifestyle. But no, you're right. Like Peter was he was a fisherman, you know, but he was also married and may have had kids as well. We don't know that for sure. And James was the brother of Jesus, through Mary and Joseph. And then, you know, the Gospel of Luke, and Luke was the physician. And like, so you have all these, like, these people existed outside of the Gospels. They existed outside of the New Testament, rather mundane ways, which is kind of nice because
it's very comforting, I suppose, to know that they were not different than us.
Yeah, it is nice to know. You know, Paul, I think to make extra money, he was a tent maker. So when he was on his journeys, you know, preaching, he would make tents and sell them to make money. Like it was just such a random, normal thing to do. And Jesus, obviously, was a carpenter. And like, yeah, they're just, you know, they had these lives outside of what we see in the Gospels. And, you know, it adds a sense of humility and humbleness to them.
You know, Jesus being a carpenter.
Yeah.
Do you wonder if ever he wandered into a place and like put his hand on a table and it kind of wobbled and then he just stopped what he was doing and fixed the table?
I think he was that guy. I bet he was. I
mean, like this chair is wobbling. Hold on. Get me an Allen wrench and
see Jesus here. I got a seat for you. Take a seat. Oh my gosh. This is gonna drive me crazy. Guys, I got to fix this. You got my tools? He's always got his tools ready to go.
That's one of those. I want to know that at some point. Like, go ahead. Yeah. Just tell me what these other moments were like.
Yeah, when you were at Zacchaeus' house, did you get really upset that the table wasn't quite level?
Like a roll? Like my knees keep hitting the table. Yeah. Hey, this thing's too short.
Okay, that's fine. No, you didn't go standard there. You went a little under standard. That's fine. No, it's fine.
30 inches is standard. This is 24 as a kiss. What are you thinking?
I can forgive a lot, guys, but come on. Take some pride. So, anyway, that's the first article. St. Peter's house finally been discovered. So, if you're ever in Israel, you can go see it. Next article is Bronze Age arrowhead made from meteorite found in Switzerland. The article starts like this. There's nothing more badass than heading into battle with a space arrow in your quiver. And one Bronze Age dude or lady, that's straight from the article, or lady knew exactly how that felt. After scanning the area of Switzerland for archaeological artifacts made of meteoric iron, researchers discovered a single arrowhead that had been forged from extraterrestrial metal. Although I believe all iron on Earth is extraterrestrial. Like, it all is. Because at one point way back when, some giant asteroid or whatever collided with Earth, and the iron core that is within Earth is the remnants of that asteroid. I believe that's...
That's a pretty heavy hit.
Yeah. I think that's how the moon got formed. I'm pretty sure that's how the moon got formed, is the Earth was just kind of doing its thing. This asteroid hits Earth, blasts it, and then the asteroid and what remains of whatever primordial Earth was coalesced into the planet we know today. And then all the debris that got knocked out formed the moon. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. I have to look into that, but that's,
yeah, that's curious.
Is extraterrestrial in that it was not originally part of the planet we know as Earth.
Well, there's something in this arrow that points them in a different direction, though, right?
Yeah. So there's this meteor like 7 miles or 7 kilometers away from where this arrowhead was found. And they're pretty sure that this arrowhead was forged from that meteorite, which is an iron meteorite.
Is it vibranium?
I wish it was. You know, what's funny is it reminds me, in DC, Vandal Savage is considered like the first metahuman on Earth, and his whole origin story is...
Okay. Sorry. Like DC comic. I thought you were like Washington, DC. I'm like, yeah, who? Washington, DC,
Vandal Savage.
Yeah, he's never on my tour.
Yeah, he rules underneath the White House. He secretly runs everything. No, Vandal Savage, DC Comics. He was the first metahuman. So all metahumans in the DC universe that are from Earth get their powers some way, shape, or form from Vandal Savage. And the reason he got his powers is a meteor hit. He was a caveman. Meteor hit Earth. He went and inspected it. It hit him with some radiation, which gave him immortality and a bunch of other powers. So when I read this article, I thought, oh, well, this arrowhead forged from him is just because it was from like 900 BC. It was probably cold forged. It was probably just hammered out of the meteorite and, you know, shaped into an arrowhead, like it wasn't smelted. So it's probably pretty primitive. But like, I just thought it was kind of cool that there's this random, you know, Bronze Age person running around with a space arrowhead in their quiver, either hunting or going on war parties or whatever it was.
I would assume that if they, you're right, like this is like chiseled.
Yeah.
Material.
So, like, I'm
so if they chiseled one arrowhead from this source, they would have chiseled more.
A bunch of tools out of it. And I actually, you know, have you ever picked up an iron meteorite? Like somewhere in our house, we have one from my wife's family. They somehow got their hands on a meteorite and it's iron and it is so dense and heavy. It looks like a rock, but then you pick it up and you're like, if you were to pick up a rock of the same size, this would weigh at least twice as much. It's so dense. And like, you can tell when you pick it up, like, yeah, this ain't normal. Pretty wild. But you're right. Yeah. They probably made all sorts of tools from it, especially if it was iron and they're in the Bronze Age, like this will give them some sort of advantage.
Yeah.
All right. Next article, the elite special forces of ancient Rome. Much like modern militaries, the famed Roman Empire had its own version of special forces. While they did not act in a similar fashion as the SAS or the Spetsnaz, they were highly specialized units handpicked to perform some of the most important jobs within the empire. The best Rome had to offer was the Praetorian Guard.
Okay, I'm going to make a little aside here, since we're talking special forces.
Yeah.
We were talking in our meeting today at school. It's our first day back as teachers. And one of the things that came up was guidelines for students, right? Like, so this one teacher had these signs and they mm-hmm. would move this arrow to the different signs. And one said theater, one said coffee shop, one said restaurant, one said shopping
like a mall,
shopping store, whatever. And so when you point the arrow at the theater, it's like the sound in the classroom should be like it is in a theater, like nobody's talking. When you go to coffee shop, people, you know, work on their own things, but they do it without wanting to be disturbed. When they're at a restaurant, you talk freely, but you don't want to hear other conversations. And when you're at the supermarket, you know, all goes. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. And I kind of, in my own way, said, I understand that. I want something different. Could we maybe do like Navy SEALs, like be silent and deadly, and then move up to like, you know, just like regular forces. And then the next like, level up is,
that'd be the obvious. Yeah.
The next level is infantry. And then, you know, the highest form is just American artillery, like be as loud as you want. But okay. I didn't quite figure out what works. I think I'm going to just rest on the coffee shop thing. I liked it, but
yeah, it's good.
Theme. I couldn't come up with it.
Yeah.
Okay. So back to these Praetorian Guard.
So the official formation of the Praetorian Guard began in the early years of the empire when Augustus took power in 27 BC, establishing the empire. He formed the unit to protect himself from political adversaries and unruly mobs, which makes sense because at this point, Rome had been in civil war since 49 BC. So for the past 20 years, they've been civil war at some point.
And I've been reading SPQR by Mary Beard.
Uh-huh.
And the part I've been reading is about like the Gracchus brothers. And one of them was just like beaten to death during just kind of not even a riot. People just got all stirred up about something. He ended up getting beaten to death. Mm. But the Gracchus brothers were introducing all these reforms and then they weren't well protected.
Yeah.
And the Senate stirred up mobs to cause problems. So yeah. It makes sense that by this time, Augustus would have learned, I need some people loyal to me.
Exactly. And so the Praetorians.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, that's what a lot of Romans learned.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Republic and the tension between the Senate and, you know, when they had dictators or praetors or quaestors or whatever. Who are the two? The
consuls.
The two consuls. Yeah, they basically ruled the Republic at the behest of the Senate, but it's like, you know, if you didn't toe the line with the Senate, your lifespan got real short real quick. And so, you know, Julius Caesar obviously upended that to an extent, and then Augustus finished that. But even after that, there's always that threat from either the Senate directly or from other generals or other members of your own family. So, yeah, you always want to have that loyal coterie of guards. And so the Praetorians numbered between 45 and 15,000 men throughout their history. And initially, when Augustus formed them, they were handpicked. They were like the toughest veterans from all these Roman legions and campaigns. Like they were the best of the best. And they had their own headquarters just outside of the city, called the Caestus Praetoria or Caestra Praetoria. But here's what's interesting, and this is where the article, you know, kind of says, here's how they're different than special forces today. We're like, even though the United States isn't at war right now with anybody, you know, there's SEALs and Delta and Rangers all around the world doing stuff, right? Like our special forces are still very active in many areas around the world. And you could say the same of any country's special forces. But Rome was different. The Praetorians almost never saw battle because their job was to guard the emperor. And the emperor did not go into battle, not very often. And so the Praetorians, by virtue of that, didn't see a lot of combat. Largely, their job was obviously protect the emperor, quell uprisings, provide security at like the games and events within the city, which is very funny to me. Like they almost became like rent-a-cops in a sense. And by the later empire, especially in the year of the five emperors, which is right. Was that right after Commodus? That was when Commodus was killed. And then there's
right storm. Before Commodus.
Well, no, because before Commodus was Marcus Aurelius. Commodus was the first emperor killed in the year of the five emperors.
Oh, the year of the five emperors. I'm thinking of the five good emperors.
Yeah. Yes. And so that, and then there was the year of the four emperors, which I think was in the late first century, but I don't remember who they were. But see, so the year of the five emperors were like general after general was taking over, and they were using the Praetorians to become the new emperor. And so basically the Praetorians were now just choosing who they wanted to be the emperor. And then the emperor, the new emperor, would promise to pay them and give them all these benefits. But then if they didn't, they'd kill that guy after a few weeks and go pick a new one. And so within that year, five emperors came and went, starting with Commodus, until finally Septimius Severus was the last one who became emperor and stayed emperor for quite a while. Anyway.
It's interesting that this Praetorian Guard was kind of a workaround to the rule that armies don't belong in Rome.
Yeah.
This was essentially a standing army within Rome.
Yeah. I think Nero was killed by his Praetorians as well.
If you were one of those Praetorian Guard, you would have done the same thing.
Well, yeah, I agree. But I'm pretty sure when the coup happened, he fled to his guards and they're like, yeah, we're going to kill you and just go with Claudius. He's at least normal. So anyway, so they say special forces, and in a sense they were, at least at the beginning, because they would have been the best of the best. But by the end, they were just another political entity, one that happened to have swords. But they were not, and a lot of their positions were towards the end, rich senators would pay to have their kid put in the Praetorian Guard because of the prestige. And so you were no longer getting a merit-based fighting group. You were now just getting graft and, kind of nepotism, which, when you look at the Russian, the Tsarist Empire.
That's what I was thinking about. It's late-stage Russian monarchy.
Mm-hmm. And, you can see how that would lead to the instability of the empire, especially when, during those periods after, Marcus Aurelius, you have a year of five emperors all being subsequently killed by their personal guard, which creates massive amounts of instability. And anyway, so it was just an interesting article because they say special forces, and yeah, kind of, but it's not like nothing like what we would think of as special forces today. Mm-mm. At least in America, maybe in other countries. All right. And then the last article, which I think is kind of the biggest news of the past week or so, at least historically, is the lost for centuries. Emperor Nero's theater is unearthed in Rome. So ruins of a private theater belonging to first century Emperor Nero have been unearthed in the Italian capital, just meters from the Vatican. Hmm. And what experts are calling an exceptional find. Until now, the existence of the ancient theater had perplexed many historians because it was mentioned in the Roman text written by Pliny the Elder, but its whereabouts had not been previously been documented. Nero, the fifth Roman emperor, ruling between 54 and 68 AD, an unpopular leader, he became famous for his extravagances and personal debaucheries. The site includes elegant marble columns, gold leaf decorations, and storage rooms with the remnants of costumes and backdrops used in Nero's theatrical productions. The dig is part of a renovation of the Palazzo del Rovere on the Via della Conciliazione, which leads to St. Peter's Square. The project will turn part of the Renaissance-era building into a Four Seasons hotel, set to open in 2025.
So is this going to delay that at all?
I guess, I don't know. It's interesting because I read the article, so there's the Palazzo della Rovere. That's the Renaissance era building that's on top of the theater. So that Renaissance era building is going to be renovated and turned into a hotel. Nero's theater is being excavated, I think they're going to take what they can out, and then they're going to rebury it and preserve it for the future, you know, if they ever want to go back there and dig again. They're going to catalog whatever they can, take whatever they can out, and then rebury it, because the best way to preserve it is to just cover it with dirt again. And then move on. So I guess 2025 is when this hotel will be done, but it's pretty wild. Like, Rome is a city with so much history that, yeah, they just found this incredible thing. And like in America, if we found that, we'd probably take a lot of effort to preserve it, mm-hmm. because we don't have as much history. But there, they're like, yeah, this is awesome. All right, take what you can. We got to finish this hotel. Like, time just marches on, man. Like, you can't preserve everything, because if you did that, you wouldn't have a city. It would just be a giant museum. Like, you've got to live with the being okay with, like, we're going to bury this theater again, because what the hell else are we going to do? Like, it's just wild to me. Anyway, Nero, one of the most famous Roman emperors, not necessarily for how good he was, but they found his theater.
Apparently not. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Better emperor. They wouldn't have buried it again. All right. So let's get to our main topic for tonight, the war machine. So Eric, I haven't seen Oppenheimer. You have. But as we were talking about it, you know, Oppenheimer and all the people at the Manhattan Project, you know, when they successfully tested the first bomb and then obviously dropped the two bombs in Japan, from that moment, everything changed in the modern world. And, you know, Oppenheimer, he's the one that he says, I have become death, destroyer of worlds. And then another one of the scientists basically said, we knew right away. That night, there was very little doubt in my mind. The world was headed for grief. That was from Leo Szilard, after recreating an experiment prior to the first successful test. But he knew the potential of a nuclear explosion and how it would change everything. Oppenheimer later said, we waited until the blast had passed, walked out of the shelter, and then it was entirely solemn. We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed. A few people cried. Most were silent. And so the bomb changed everything, not just for Japan, but it changed everything for America, Russia, the world at large, because now we had a weapon, humanity, capable of destroying the entire human race. And everything about how nations behaved prior to the bomb and how they behaved after the bomb was a direct result of those explosions. You know, the global arms race started. Russia started making nuclear weapons. Other nations did, but they never wanted to use them. Like we wanted to have them so we could destroy our enemy, but we were really cautious about using them. You know, even the Cuban Missile Crisis was just a bunch of de-escalation because everything was getting out of hand. We're like, what can we do to avoid this thing happening?
Yeah, and you had the potential for MacArthur to use them during the Korean War. He wanted to use nuclear weapons to just wrap it up and get it over with. But it does become this, you know, you can't use it without risking it being used on you. So your best option is not to use it.
Yeah.
And the drawback there is that any conflict you have with a nuclear nation gets drawn out into proxy conflicts and into third world countries, and they have to pay the price for those two countries not going to war with each other. I saw the film. I'm listening to the book American Prometheus, on which the film is based. Oppenheimer was a fascinating character. And the Manhattan Project and the people involved with it were fascinating characters, because they all had, you know, they were engineers and scientists and mathematicians and all of these different fields, but they also were people mm-hmm. who were concerned about how this was going to be used. They certainly wanted it to be used to end the war. And primarily their initial thought was this would be used on Hitler, on Nazi Germany.
Sure.
That was the objective. And then the war ended in Europe. And so it was like, well, we have this. Do we need to use it? Do we need to bring this to an end? But it changes everything once that happens. It changes how you calculate the cost of war.
Yeah. And it was, you know, prior to the bomb and even after, for a time there, there was a very real possibility that the United States and the Soviet Union were headed to a hot war on over Europe and in the Pacific and in Asia. Like, that was a real fear. Like, Patton, like, he kept wanting to go east. And you know, there's this idea that if cooler heads don't prevail, we'll go into a hot war, one that the United States may not win against the Soviet Union at that time. In, you know, the Soviet Union had millions of men in Europe, and they didn't necessarily want to stop at Germany. They wanted to keep going. And the bomb changed that dynamic in a matter of moments, mm-hmm. because now, even though the United States may not have the manpower to go toe-to-toe with the Soviet Union in that moment, they now had a weapon that could wipe out hundreds of thousands of soldiers in a blink. And the Soviet Union didn't have it for that first few years there.
No. And, but they knew we had it.
Yep.
And even before we used it, they knew we had it. They knew we were building it. It certainly changes how everyone thinks about the next few years.
Sure.
One other interesting thing was that during the Manhattan Project, one of the things they kept going back to was the Halifax explosion in 1917, where the ship loaded with high explosives caught fire and exploded.
Mm.
It killed 2,000 people.
Jeez.
Like, that was the largest man-made explosion at that time. 2.9 kilotons of TNT. And, you know, it was an entire ship that exploded. But one of their, you know, kind of thoughts in the Manhattan Project is, how do we put that type of power into something that can be delivered by an airplane? Because you can't sail an entire ship into a harbor and blow it up. So. Yeah. The idea is, can we create a reaction that will create this kind of explosion that can be delivered by an airplane?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it changes how not just war is fought, but really how countries use diplomacy.
You know, in diplomacy, all of a sudden, you know, after World War One, we had the League of Nations, which was very ineffectual, and you can throw your criticisms at the United Nations now, but, you know, after World War II, the United Nations, people got it. They're like, yeah, maybe this is a good thing we talk about this stuff. Like, let's see if we can figure out how to way to not destroy all of humanity. And then you have NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that gets established, and then you have the Warsaw Pact, and you have, like, this pressure with these two hegemons, and everyone understands that they don't like each other, and if they could, they would, but they also know it's not worth the collateral damage. As bad as it got, they were not willing to take that next step. So we'll fight our proxy wars. We'll go fight over the Korean Peninsula, or you know, Indochina, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and we'll position all these bombs, but we're not, you know, we went against our normal instinct when it comes to war, and at least the United States and Russia, and said, there's got to be a way to avoid this worst possible scenario. And it just, you know, everything about the next 70 years was just based on the bomb. Like, everything was, the way we functioned as a society, the way we built up our military industrial complex, our economy, everything was centered around the bomb. And the world would be very, very different had the bomb not been developed and it been used. And I don't know if it would be better. that's the other thing is, I don't know if the world would be better off had the bomb not been developed and used, which is says a lot because it was terrifying and very destructive. But
yeah, because the choice to take war to your enemy only backfires on your people if you lose and they come back to you, right? If they push you back. Mm-hmm. If, so you can invade other countries, and as long as you sue for peace before they get to your border, your people are relatively fine. Mm-hmm. The nuclear weapons creates a situation where you never have the advantage.
Yeah.
Even if you have strategically placed missiles close to your enemy, it's still not good enough.
Yeah, you winning still may destroy.
There is no winning.
Yeah. That's the difference. And so it was one of the it shocked the collective conscience of the world. Even though everybody wanted them, everybody wanted nuclear weapons because they wanted to be able to, quote unquote, defend themselves. But they weren't super keen on using them because they knew the consequences could be the destruction of all of humanity. Like, it changed everything. So with that in mind, what other technologies specifically geared towards warfare changed the shape of the world and the shape of how warfare was fought and the rise and fall of empires and dynasties? I don't know if anything is quite as impactful as the bomb, but there's some really interesting contenders out there. So,
I've had this line in my head for 3 days.
You hit me.
Let's go from string theory to string theory. Right? The bow and arrow? Come on.
The bow and arrow, yeah.
It's classic.
So at one point, they say, depending on where you're reading, the earliest known evidence of the bow and arrow may date from South Africa 60,000 years ago. They found some arrowheads possibly 70,000 years ago. But the oldest depictions we have of combat, there's an Iberian cave from the Mesolithic era. Several thousand years ago, showing a cave painting of archers, three archers encircled by a group of four. And this is in Spain, in Valencia, Spain. And so the bow and arrow from thousands and thousands of years ago, up until very, very recently, was the most advanced weapon technology humanity had. It was the pinnacle of warfare technology for a very long time. And, empires rose and fall based on their ability to use the bow and arrow. Egypt used it extensively as early as 2700 BCE. A lot of their archers were actually Nubians, and Nubia was known as the land of the bow. Their archers in Nubia were just excellent. So Egypt just hired them and had them be their missile troops in their army. The Persians, the Chinese, Koreans, Babylonians, all of them had used extensively archery in warfare. And all of those countries established large kingdoms or empires as a result of their military prowess with the bow and arrow. I think the Neo-Assyrians were the first professional army, and that was around 900 BCE. They were once they able to use combined arms tactics, have an infantry in front, your missile troops in back, cavalry flanking on the sides. But the missile troops are really what won the day, because if you can destroy your enemy from 200-300 yards away, that's way better than just charging in with your infantry to fight in close combat. And so, yeah, bow and arrow.
Yeah, it certainly changes how those pitched battles are going to be fought.
Yep.
Because you no longer have to account for how heavy their infantry is or where the cavalry is coming from. Now you also have to handle the battle now becomes three-dimensional, right? Like mm-hmm. you also have to deal with stuff falling from the sky and yeah. you are not within range of those archers. And if you mm-hmm. are within range of the archers, if you do have your own archers,
yeah,
it becomes this, you know, it's tactics and strategy of where to place them so they can either render your enemy ineffective in using them or deplete their infantry before yours are depleted.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's certainly the fact that you can, from a safe distance, inflict damage on your opponent is, I mean, it is the atomic bomb, right?
Yeah.
We're going to inflict damage from far away. We are not taking a risk in doing this anymore.
And it was the gun. It was the machine gun, right? Like, they were able to put so many arrows in the air that even if they weren't getting through your shields or armor, they were exhausting you because you had to march through that fire just mm-hmm. to get to their lines. And so, you know, obviously not all arrows are made the same. A lot of the earlier arrows or bows and arrows, the bows are horned. They're made from like animal horns. And then sometime later, around like I think 1000 BC, they were able to develop like composite bows, which had a lot stronger draw and were able to penetrate armor better, but they had a lot more distance, more accurate. You know, so not everything is the same, but like just the idea that we have this thing. And even if the other army has missile troops, like slingers, you know, think of like David and Goliath. David used a sling to fell Goliath. Well, that doesn't have the same distance. That doesn't have the same power as a bow and arrow does. Javelin, same thing. Yeah, they're great, but you can only throw a javelin so far. An arrow can go much, much farther, much more accurately. And so it was just a good army that had a good contingent of missile troops with bows and arrows was going to technologically dominate anybody that didn't have that. And I think it just kind of changes this perception that we have of warfare in ancient times as glorious charges and infantry clashing, which, yeah, that happened. But like the great empires, they didn't just charge. They thought and were able to use tactics and combined arms warfare to win the day and establish these huge, huge kingdoms and empires.
Well, next up, you have the chariot,
mm-hmm.
which I think is interesting.
It is. So this is probably developed in the Eurasian steppe, most likely 1900 BCE. Horses are probably domesticated 3500 BCE. So for much, much longer than the first chariot, but those horses are probably domesticated as beasts of burden, not something to ride into battle. Just like the camel or, you know, the cattle, cows and stuff would have been domesticated as beasts of burden. But the chariot came in 1900 BCE. It was typically light carriage, two-wheeled vehicles drawn by usually two horses, sometimes more. And it usually had two people. You had the person driving the chariot, and then you had an archer. So again, bow and arrow. And so they were mobile missile cavalry. That's what they were. You could use them in formations to charge infantry. They could put scythes on the wheels to cut out their legs from under them. But more often than not, they were used as missile troops to surround the enemy and, again, pester them with bow and arrow.
Yeah, and I mentioned the Battle of Kadesh. This is mm-hmm. one of these very large battles in early, like in ancient history.
Yeah.
Roughly around 100,000, up to 100,000 troops, of which, you know, about 10 to 15,000 chariots between the two sides. The Hittites had up to 10,000 chariots.
Yeah.
Against the Egyptian 2,000. And I think we associate chariots with the Egyptians. They seem to have perfected it at some point. But again, the ability to have that kind of maneuverability, the ability, the ability to move quickly in a direction and also with momentum. Right. Yeah. Like horses and a cavalry charge will fail against a line of men that do not move. But how many lines of men stand their ground against charging horse?
Well, and especially if this is the first time you've ever seen that.
Yeah.
Like you're in battle and you're used to a group of men on one side of the hill or a field charging, and maybe they have bows and arrows shooting at each other. And then a group of men at the other side charging, shooting at each other. And all of a sudden you throw in this 1,200-pound monster carrying two guys with bows and arrows, like, and there's hundreds of them or thousands of them. Like, you've never seen that before in warfare.
Or heard the sound.
Yeah. Like, it would be terrifying to be, like, this small, petty kingdom, and all of a sudden this massive army, thousands of chariots, comes over the hill. And you'd be like, well, it was good. We had a good run. Like, let's just surrender, because I've never seen this thing before. Like at one point it didn't exist and now it does, and everything is different. Like, you can't have a successful army, just like you couldn't have a successful army without a bow and arrow, a contingent of bow and arrow or archers. You're not going to have a successful military without a contingent of chariots.
Like, and that, and one of the notes here you have is that the last time it was used was in 84 AD in England, and then it just stopped.
Yeah, like, because by then, by the time Rome, you know, when Caesar found England, you know, the British Isles were very isolated, and so they were still using chariots pretty extensively. By this point, cavalry had developed, which leads into the next thing. And as fun as chariots are, mounted cavalry is far superior, whether it's missile cavalry or heavy cavalry with lances or whatever.
Probably less maintenance.
Mm-hmm. You have one rider per horse, so you don't need two people to, you don't need one guy just to drive and another to shoot. You know, and with chariots, so they could be used to charge infantry. That wasn't their best use. Their best use was flanking and harassing. Whereas cavalry, especially heavy cavalry, like the cataphracts of like Persia and Media, and those guys could charge an infantry formation and break it. But that didn't develop until like 900 BCE, like the Neo-Assyrian Empire. And the first cavalry, they didn't have stirrups. They didn't have saddles. It was just people riding on the back of a horse, which was very, very difficult to control. And they were primarily used as missile cavalry. But over the centuries, they were able to, you know, by, I think the saddle was developed shortly thereafter. And then I think the stirrup wasn't invented until like 100 BCE. And the stirrup really gives you a lot of control of the horse. You don't have to use your hands as much. And they didn't. It was one of the later inventions in the development of cavalry. But once it was, and then the Medians were able to breed very large horses. And so they were you could have heavily armored people riding the horses with big lances. And then they could have those big cavalry charges. So yeah, by the time the Romans.
And I think it was the stirrup that really allowed cavalry to become a worthwhile force.
Yeah.
Right?
Because you stand up in your stirrup and drive forward.
Control your horse and also keep it in formation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, yeah, like the stirrup, it's just these weird little technology things. Like, the chariot changed warfare because now you can use animals in war. In an organized way. And then the saddle and the stirrup changed cavalry warfare, because now you didn't need the chariot. Now you could just ride the horse. And they modified that for camels and then, you know, elephants as well. But these just simple technology changes changed everything. And so the kings and empires that had chariots for a long time and were dominating, well, these upstarts just have cavalry and your chariots aren't really that useful anymore. You know, it's just, and then the country that adapts the quickest is the one that thrives for the next 100 years or two.
You wrote here, in one of these notes, the largest cavalry charge, the Battle of Vienna, mm-hmm. 1683, 18,000 cavalry against the Ottoman Turks.
Yeah.
Oh, the Winged Hussars.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a song.
Winged Hussars, yeah. 3,000.
Sabaton. That I think it's about that, right? Like, I got to double check it.
It's, yeah. And so there's the Vienna was being besieged by the Ottoman Turks. This battle lasted like 2 months. It was a huge, like, it took forever. But on, was it September 12th, 18,000 cavalry charge towards the besieging Ottomans, led by 3,000 Winged Hussars from Poland. And they just destroyed the Ottomans. The siege of Vienna was broken. This kind of stalled or stopped Ottoman expansion into Europe. And so, in a sense, you could say it saved Europe from Ottoman conquest, at least, or at least Eastern and Central Europe. So it was a huge, huge battle. And then, what was the last? The last U.S. cavalry battle was the battle, largest U.S. cavalry battle, I should say. It was the Battle of Brandy Station, June 9, 1863. 11,000 Union versus 9,000 Confederate cavalry. The Confederates won. Don't worry, they still lost the war. But they won that battle. I know. And then the last cavalry charge, successful one, was the Battle of Schoenfield, March 1st, 1945. The Polish again. Charged German positions in Schoenfeld. The Germans retreated. It wasn't very large. I think it was like 500 Germans dead, about 100 Polish cavalrymen. But this was the last successful cavalry charge because everything was mechanized by this point.
Well, we say everything was mechanized. The only army, I believe the only army in World War II that was fully mechanized was the U.S. Army.
I think
the British, the Germans, they were still using horses, not for cavalry, but to haul equipment. Most militaries were still using horse, and the U.S. had moved on almost completely from that for World War II.
Well, what's funny about it is because Poland has this just very rich cavalry history. You know, everyone kind of dogs on the Polish in World War II because, you know, look how quickly they lost to Germany. You know, was it 3 weeks or whatever?
They also inflicted more casualties on the Germans in that 1 month.
That's what I was going to say.
Than the British and French did, like, for a year and a half.
Yeah, and a lot of it was their cavalry. It's like, yeah, even though Germany is coming in with the Blitzkrieg and all this armor and stuff, the Polish army and their cavalry put up a heck of a fight, even though they lost relatively quickly. They did some damage in that time.
So Poland's military heritage is tied very closely to German military heritage, especially like the Teutonic Knights.
Mm-hmm.
So it shouldn't surprise anyone.
No. And so it's kind of cool to see that the last successful cavalry charge was the Polish. Like, even though it wasn't a huge one, it was like, it was kind of a fitting send off there. But it's like, yeah, even until, you know, so again, from 2700 BC until 1945, horses and warfare, if you had the best horses or you had the best cavalry or, you know, best horse technology like saddles and stirrups, you were going to dominate in battle. And that carried all the way up until the middle of the 20th century. Which is just wild that something so simple was so effective for so long across the entirety of the world. You know, all these other advances came, but you had to have a horse if you wanted to win the battle. You know, the Mongols being perfect examples of that. They created the largest empire in history based on
the backs of horses.
On the backs of horses using bows and arrows. The largest contiguous empire in history. And obviously they adapted as they moved and conquered more and more territory, but that was the strength of their military and it lasted a very long time. All right, so the next one, getting more into the modern age, gunpowder. Which, obviously, we know the importance of gunpowder in warfare today. It was first discovered by the Chinese around 850 AD because they were looking for like life lengthening elixirs.
Don't drink that.
They found gunpowder instead. It blew up a house. Like it was just. It was funny because when we did the episode a couple weeks ago about oil and the discovery of oil, it was the same thing. The indigenous people that lived in the Americas were using it like for elixirs and ways to stay healthy. And Europeans saw that and did the same thing. And then it's like, yeah, that's all great. But here's what it's really good for.
If you light it on fire.
Yeah. Look at this. So it's just, yeah. So in 850 AD is when they figured it out, you know, with saltpeter. To their credit, they quickly put it to use. They would make flying fire. So an arrow fixed with a tube of gunpowder that was sent into the enemy lines. So basically a super primitive rocket. And then over time, you know, they would develop that more. They would create like kind of cannons or rockets, but they would like use bamboo to kind of create the tubes and stuff like that. But it wasn't really until the 13th century that gunpowder made it into Europe and into the Islamic world. Again, a big part of that is thanks to the Mongols. And then in Europe, at least, bell makers were the ones that were able to make the first cannons.
Yeah.
They could take the technology they used to make bells and then shape that into bombards. To make cannons. And then from there you had like arquebuses, kind of primitive guns. And although they were very ineffective and took a long time to reload, they were blasting through plate armor and chainmail, and things that would stop an arrow were now just getting destroyed by these high explosive projectiles.
Which changes another aspect of warfare in that, okay, so now armor, chainmail is obsolete, which actually now the type of equipment you need to have is just, it becomes somewhat less expensive to outfit yourself for war.
You don't need heavily armed and armored knights.
I can imagine being the guy who just finished his castle, built these massive walls, super proud. And then some guy's like, hey, did you hear we have cannons now? Those walls aren't going to hold up. Just wasted all your money.
Constantinople being the biggest example, it had never fallen, you know, until 1453 when the Turks took these big cannons that were originally offered to Constantinople, but they couldn't afford it. So then they sold them to the Turks, and the Turks said, yeah, we'll use them, and blew those walls apart. And these were huge, massive walls that had stood for centuries. And
you think about how castles were shaped prior to gunpowder, right? They're some sort of, you know, usually a square rectangle. They have their towers and their parapets. But after the advent of gunpowder, you start to get these fortresses that are more like star-shaped,
mm-hmm.
so that they can bring cannons into them, but also aim from a variety of directions.
Yep.
Because now you can use guns from the top of these fortresses.
Yep.
So it changes the way that fortresses are shaped and the way they're used and the way you defend.
Yeah. You know, and prior to then, before gunpowder, you know, your heavy artillery was like a trebuchet, catapult, which was destructive, certainly. But again, it's just flinging rocks, you know, and it's using momentum and tension. It's not using something that can crack the sound barrier and send it a mile away. Like that, that's the change that gunpowder had. And like you said, now you, you didn't need a bunch of knights and men at arms. You could train people to use these guns, stand in a line, fire, reload.
Cavalry
forward
becomes slowly becomes obsolete. One of my favorite scenes that I show I show the students the whole film of War Horse. But my favorite scene from that is the scene you've got Benedict Cumberbatch's character and the actor for Loki,
Tom Hiddleston.
They're two officers, cavalry officers in the British Army, and it's very early on in the war. It's like spring 1915 or fall 1914. And they're going to go on this cavalry charge, and they have this moment in the forest along this road, you know, for God, for king, for country. They take their horses into a field, they mount up, and they charge a German garrison that's encamped, and they rip through the garrison, and you're like, wow, look at that. And then the garrison retreats into the woods, and it just pans to a German machine gun. And they pull it back and they just start firing these machine guns. Steven Spielberg is a master filmmaker, and the way he does it without showing a bunch of gore is he goes from the charging cavalry with the men on the horseback to riderless horses running past the machine guns. And the sound is all the cavalrymen like shouting as they go to machine gun fire and no more shouting. And it goes back and forth. And in this one scene, my students learn the machine gun has changed this war. It changed war for all time. Like, cavalry is no longer going. Like, British cavalry 20 years before this would have rolled over this garrison and had a victory with almost no casualties.
Yeah,
and here, they're wiped out. Well, and go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, you know, and that was a lesson that the United States learned earlier than continental Europe because of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And you could tell by the end of the Civil War, the United States knew this is changing because the Gatling gun came out, right? And then later you had the Hotchkiss gun. And so these repeating rifles, and like we were learning quicker because we had a huge war in the middle of the 1800s when all this technology was changing, that the cavalry is not going to be used the same way it ever was before. And so, you know, by the World War One, continental Europe hadn't really learned that lesson yet.
And even after observing the Russo-Japanese War,
exactly,
they just hadn't said, this is how it's going to be fought.
Well, yeah, they saw the Russo-Japanese War and like, well, yeah, obviously the Russians failed because they suck at war. We're better at it. So that we won't have this issue.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, well, nice try. So, but, you know, in so then cavalry, you know, throughout the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, it's no longer glorious charges unless you just want to get cut to ribbons. Now you're using it for scouting or reconnaissance or flanking or harassing, but you're not using it as you would as this jackhammer to just blast through a line. And then, you know, then you can fill it in with your infantry and then, you know, chase all the routing soldiers. Now you have to use it a lot more strategically. And not that they didn't before, but the whole concept of cavalry changed, at least horse-drawn cavalry, changed as a result of not just gunpowder, because gunpowder was invented in 1850 or 850. It didn't make it to Europe until 1300. It wasn't the invention of gunpowder. It wasn't even the invention of the gun. It was the repeating rifle and the machine gun. That's what changed it for cavalry, for the whole world. Because cavalry could still, you know, a line of soldiers that are firing at a rate of one or two shots a minute isn't going to be able to fire fast enough to stop them.
Yeah, that kind of infantry becomes that becomes hand-to-hand combat within a few minutes.
Yeah.
And that's where cavalry really becomes
those lancers come
effective.
In
yeah.
Cut them apart. And so, anyway, yeah, the gunpowder changed things, but it actually took a while for the change that gunpowder brought, you know, to the world of warfare. You know, it took over 1,000 years for it to get to where it is now, where everything we know about war is different because of gunpowder. Like, that just wasn't the case. Like, yeah, the gun was nice and it was kind of a novelty, but, you know, if you needed an army on the cheap, bows and arrows still worked really well for quite a long time, and cavalry worked great until the 20th century, you know? And then the last thing I wanted to go over was blue water navigation. And before we get into what happened in the 1400s, the first to blue water navigate were the Polynesians, right?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
And I mean, you've kind of researched this a little more than I have, but how'd that go? Like,
so, I mean, they knew how to wayfind. They knew how to find these locations that were spread out all over the place. But where it changes war, the Polynesians never get to a point where it changes their level of warfare. And even, you know, we talk about Europe and European exploration in the 13, 14, 1500s. Even that's only changing warfare in so much as it's giving them an opportunity to expand their empires. It's really kind of like the 16, 1700s when the British and the Spanish begin to use these navies less for exploration, more to dominate, you know, the regions that they can dominate the Atlantic Ocean. Once you can go beyond your coastline with confidence, you know, and you get to something like the Bretton Woods Agreement. That's basically the United States has the most dominant blue water navy, and we're going to use it to secure peace for everyone who wants to trade.
Yeah.
You know, it's being able to dominate anybody you come across out in the ocean away from your home ports that allows the British, the Spanish to create these massive empires and eventually the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's interesting about, you know, like when you talk about the Roman Empire, you know, and they hugged the Mediterranean, you know, Rome was a very naval empire because they controlled the Mediterranean. They could control all the trade along the Mediterranean, and they could move troops faster, right? And their logistics and all this stuff. And that's one of the huge advantages Rome had, is that they were able to move faster because they controlled the water of the Mediterranean. Well, once blue water navigation hit, so, and what we mean by that is in the 1400s, Portugal, under a guy named Henry the Navigator, was able to take these newly developed caravel ships, which were bigger, they're faster and lighter, and they had a square sail, and they're able to go farther distances. And he was able to use that to navigate, you know, to like the Azores, which is pretty far off of the coast. And you could now go far beyond your coastline into the blue water and get back. And then, you know, what that allowed was as they expanded farther and farther until 1492 with Columbus, all of this was in a push to find a sea route to the Far East. Because at the time, the Ottomans controlled the spice trade. They controlled the Silk Road. And so Europe couldn't get the spices and the goods that they wanted from the East unless they had to, you know, pay through the nose to the Ottomans. And if the Ottomans shut it off, that was the end of the story. And so a big part of the reason the Europeans did this is because they wanted to find another route So either go around Africa or go around the world to the other side, and then they could create sea lanes. And so the Portuguese are the first to figure this out. The Spanish quickly figured it out, obviously established, you know, their colonies in the New World. And then the British and the Dutch and the French all got into it. Germany much, much later, you know, started establishing these colonies across the world. And at one point, the British had the largest empire ever. I think they controlled, I think, a quarter of the land mass on the world, around the world, and said the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, that worked because they had the best navy, and they were able to establish all these colonies and dominate anybody that was in this area through just the sheer power of their navy.
And then keep them connected too.
Yeah.
Because it does no good to go set up a colony and then not have reliable modes of communication between them. It's what allowed the Romans with their roads. They could communicate with the entire empire. The British, you know, how do you maintain control over Australia? Well, you always have ships arriving, right? Yep. So maintaining those all those little tentacles into every region allows you to maintain that empire. And if you can't do that because there's another dominant navy, you're going to lose that empire.
Yep. And then these navies, you know, Spain had their huge armada, and then they fought the English and lost, and the Dutch had a powerful navy, and the French built up theirs, and so all these massive navies developed as a result of the ability to navigate the oceans. And previously land powers, specifically the Ottomans, but all throughout the Silk Road, as you've mentioned, Eric, they were no longer relevant. They didn't have the impact that they had centuries prior because the British and the French and the Germans just go around them. They didn't need to drive their wagons for 3 years across Asia to get to China. They could just sail and get there much, much, much faster. But, you know, and then it just, it changed warfare for sure, but it changed everything about the world. Because now nothing was out of reach if you had a good enough navy.
And you could show up along the coast or in the bay of another nation with your ships, with your massive guns.
Mm-hmm.
Much like Matthew Perry did in Japan. Well,
you're going to trade with us now. No, we're not. Yeah. Boom. Okay, we'll trade with you now. Yeah. That's how quickly it happened.
I think, you know, the negotiation with Japan was, we're going to come back and we're going to be ready for trade. Mm-hmm. And whatever Japan's response was, it was more of a, it doesn't matter what your response is. I'm coming back with more ships and we're just going to open up trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But, oh, yeah, those guns. Oh, yeah, I forgot about those.
Mm-hmm.
Here's our massive navy. You know, it sends a message. And for so long, a massive navy sent that message.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go to something like, well, World War II rolls around and suddenly all of those battleships obsolete, rendered obsolete in a matter of 4 years.
Yeah.
Sorry, battleships no longer make a difference. It is aircraft carriers.
Yeah. Not to totally slight the battleship. Like, they were still using them up until the 90s, but they were these giant mobile weapon platforms. Like, they had Patriot missiles towards the end. And so you could use them in a lot of different factors. But the idea of, like, we need to have these huge guns because we're going to slug it out with that other ship. That was like, no, over. We don't need more.
You get something like the Exocet missile, which can be launched by a plane that will ram into the side of a ship and explode in the center.
Yeah.
It's just a ship killer.
But for 300-400 years, that's how naval battles were fought. You had the biggest ships with the biggest guns, you know, ships of the line. And they would broadside each other as they sailed by, and then they'd turn around and do it again until one of them gave up or sank.
It is amazing.
Missouri was. It was the final form of that. Like that's what those ships were.
It's amazing because we've kind of come full circle back to World War II, back to when the atom bomb was developed. And it feels like, well, you develop the atom bomb, that's kind of it. But the level of technology we have advanced in the shadow of nuclear warfare, you know, night vision, special ops, high altitude, low open drops, drone warfare, like it's still moving forward. There's still like game changing things ahead of us. Nuclear war is still a possibility. It's still, you know, we've proliferated enough weapons to do the job, but we haven't quit like creating weapon systems that are effective at the conventional level.
Yeah. And you look at, and it's funny because things like, you know, with the war in Ukraine, things that we thought, you know, from an American standpoint, like, yeah, we're never going to do this again. Like trench warfare. Well, it's one of the best defenses either side has in that conflict. Dig a ditch, cover it up where you can, and hide. Because even though these drones are really advanced and we've all these guided missile systems, digging in a standing in a ditch is one of your best forms of protection against all this really great technology.
But and, you can take a so yeah that. The war in Ukraine has gone into some sorts of trench warfare, right?
Sure.
And we have that because we know that because we have video footage of drones flying over trenches and dropping ordnance into the trenches. Like with a level of precision that seems odd considering you're dropping it from a drone and it's basically a grenade.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little
wild. It's wild. Like everything, not everything, but a lot of the things that people had assumptions on with war and technology. And it's like, well, we've got all these drones and see if we can do this stuff. And you have this highly mobile battlefield. It's like, nah, it's going to settle into a trench and it's going to be a slog to move anybody out. And the best way to stop tanks is to put giant cinder blocks of dragon's teeth in the way. And like, and so just this weird combination of like, what we consider primitive technology married with hyper advanced technology. And it's not a matter of like who has the most advanced technology wins. It's who can use all of these things best to their advantage. Who's the better, you know, who's the most creative and the, you know, in resourceful, that's who's seen, you know, an effect on the battlefield today. So yeah, you're right. Yeah. Just because we invented the bomb doesn't mean things stopped. In fact, things have advanced far beyond anything we could probably imagine, or Oppenheimer certainly could have imagined. So anyway, those paradigm shifting weapons, just to wrap this all up, you know, the atomic bomb was paradigm shifting for the world, but it wasn't the only thing. And throughout history, you know, maybe nothing is quite on the scale of the bomb, but if you can put yourself in the shoes of being the first person to see, you know, you see your first cavalry charge from an enemy army, or the bow and arrow is developed, or, you know, the first countries that can figure out how to sail across the ocean, something that was previously unthought of. How the world in that moment changes from one that you knew and understood to one that is completely unknown and foreign. Those weapons, the technologies behind them changed the world as a result of them. And I think that's just, it adds a lot of perspective to this, because while the atomic bomb was new, there's going to be another thing in the future that'll be that thing that changes everything for us. And just kind of good to keep it in perspective like that.
Yeah.
All right. So let's wrap this up. I got one question for you, Eric, and I wish Cameron was on, because he kind of brought this up. But tipping, have we gone too far?
Good. Tipping, yeah, in America? You know, it's not, I don't know, because I think there was at one point a convention for tipping that everyone was aware of. And now it's built into
10% was kind of a subpar. Yeah, you got me my food, but it wasn't great.
15% was a tip.
And then 20 is if they went above and beyond. And I'm not, I think that's a good system. I generally still use that system. I think 20% is more than enough for most things. But Cameron's like, what he said? He was like at a Target.
And he was buying jeans from somewhere.
And they said they had like on a card reader, do you want a tip? Who are you tipping? Like, it's self-pay. Yeah. It's not like you got somebody in the back hemming jeans.
I think it's, you know, it's built into the payment app, right? Those point of sale apps. It's just built in, and most everyone leaves the tipping part on. You know, I go to a sandwich shop nearby and they have the tip. And I feel weird because they're like, all right, go ahead, fill that out. And they're looking down and I click no. Like, you made a sandwich. Good job. You're not waiting tables.
Yeah, that's the thing. So, like, if you provide service, if you're getting paid, like, if you're a waitress or waiter, yeah, absolutely, I'm going to tip you because you're paid criminally low, right? The tip makes sense there. If you are delivering my food, yeah, I'm going to tip you. But outside of that, why am I tipping you? Like, I'm saving work if I go to pick up my food. Why should I tip
that? There's a, so apparently you're supposed to tip your postal worker and your deliver any like package deliver around Christmas.
Oh, you're, well, I've heard you're supposed to like postal workers like gift cards and stuff. You know, yeah,
Christmas. I remember. But a postal worker, it may have been in like my parents' neighborhood, was saying like, don't forget your postal worker this season. And he was saying that to everybody. It's like, I don't know. But I get it. But I don't know. Saying, hey, don't forget.
I get it. But it's also like, I'm not saying postal workers don't work hard, because they do. But they also get compensated fairly well for the work that they do.
Yeah.
Like, if they were getting paid, you know, a nickel per package, yeah, I guess you tip them, but they get a salary, they get defined benefits, they get weeks off, you know, every year. Like, I understand that, you know, like if you know your postal worker, like I know the name of my mailman, because we've talked a couple times. So, like, yeah, I would give him a gift card or something like that at Christmas, but only because I know him. Like, I guess that's the difference. Like, if I don't know you, why am I tipping you?
Well, and so, like, in California, especially where I live, all the mailboxes are like at a commute, like at a, it's a big box.
Sure.
For all the mail.
Oh, yeah.
It's like I never see this person. Well, but my parents live in Arizona and everyone has their own mailbox.
Yeah.
But neighborhoods are going away from that. I think that's kind of a new standard. It's like, if you're not coming up to my door and I'm not waving at you, like I only see you when I happen to drive by, that's tricky. But what I've noticed with tipping is we went to a restaurant the other day for lunch, and at the bottom, it said, like, it gave tipping options. You could check a box. Like, here's your total. Here's a box. Here's a box. Here's a box. 18%, 20%, 22%.
Mm-hmm.
And then it showed me the amount next to each one. And then it said other below it.
Yeah.
And the way I always tip, like, first of all, I always thought 15% was the standard. That's average. But now it's like, no, 18% is... feels low. I always aim for like 18 if it's good service, but I always like to write in my own tip so that whatever my total is, it's a round number.
Mm-hmm.
So if like the meal was 39.22, I'm like, well, you know, I'll probably make it around 48. So 8.78. will be my tip, just because I want it rounded up to a round number. But
yeah, no, I know. I've seen you do that before, and I know other people that do that as well. And I think that makes sense. But it's also like, I don't know, just these point of sale systems and like, and I know why they do it, because people are pretty suggestible. But again, I don't have a problem with tipping servers or people that like my pizza delivery or whatever it is. I don't have a problem with that. But just like any random store, do you want to tip or do you want to donate to this? Or like, do you want to round up for this?
Well, the donation things, because I was very suggestible. Like, all right. They bother me now because what they're doing is they're getting money in that they get to donate. Mm-hmm. That will be a tax deduction for the company.
Yeah.
Not for me, for the company.
Yep.
Like, that's all it is. It's literally money laundering. It's just a way for them to shuffle the money through their accounts for their revenue and then write off the whole thing.
Yep.
And it costs me almost nothing, but come on.
Like, I want to ask, like, I'm not going to be that guy just being a jerk to these workers. But, like when they're, like, you know, with cameras, do you want a tip for buying jeans? Like, I would want to ask somebody that works there, like, who's getting this tip? Like, are you, you know, guy that's been folding jeans? Are you cashier? Are you the manager? Like, who's getting this tip? Or is it just going to the store and the company? Like, that's where I'm like, I don't, like, again, you tip the person, you don't tip the company. The company's not done anything extra to earn your money. The person may or may not have, but not the company.
And that's one of the problems with these tips. If they're digital, they're recorded, they become a tax liability for the person receiving the tip.
Yeah.
Whoever that is, by the way, which is odd.
Yeah.
So when I worked, when I was a golf cart washer in high school, worked at the golf course, the guys upstairs, the guys who took care of the clubs, scrubbed them down, took care of people as they came in, people would tip them $5, $10, $20, maybe more. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a nice hotel and golf course. But, you know, those guys were college age. We were high school age. So at the end of the night, they would cut us in to the tips. So they pooled their tips. They kind of divided up amongst themselves and then cut a little portion out for us. And they'd come down and they'd say, hey, here's $15. Here's $20, $25, maybe $40. Yeah. It was, I mean, I was making like $5.25 an hour.
Yeah.
This was 26 years ago. Man, I getting a $20 bill handed to you because they got tipped a lot. That was pretty nice.
Yeah.
It just went right into my pocket. It was a wonderful thing.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. It's really frustrating. Like, I'm the same way. I'm like, the more I see these, like, do you want to donate to this or do this? I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not donating that. Like, unless you're a server and you're going above and beyond, I'm not tipping Taco Bell. like you know, Taco Bell has not earned money beyond the price of the food. Like, so it's not happening. You know, thanks for trying, but anyway, just wanted to throw that out there. So thank you all for joining us. That wraps up our episode tonight. Hope you guys all had a great time. And thank you so much. We'll try to see you next week. And if we don't see you, have a great day in history. Bye.